Today is Thursday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up, Phil Mercer has the latest on the bushfires in Australia. Also, we take a closer look at U.S. troop deployments to Iraq, and the Turkey's parliament approves sending troops to Libya. It's all on today's International Edition. In our top story, as the U.S. embassy staff in Baghdad begin to clean up the damage caused by pro-Iranian protesters on Tuesday and Wednesday, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, says the game has changed. He says the risk of new attacks remains.
And by the way, if we get word of attacks or some type of indication, we will take preemptive action as well to protect American forces, to protect American lives.
And that was U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper speaking at a press conference just hours ago. The U.S., of course, has additional troops on the way to the region. And to fill us in on the latest, we're joined on the line now by VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Carla, hello to you.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Now, you were at that press briefing just hours ago, and tell us a little bit more about the status of the U.S. troop deployment following this briefing. Where are the troops coming from? Where are they going? And what exactly is their mission?
Well, to sum it up, basically, when there was the attack on the embassy, when the Molotov cocktails were being thrown, the flames started during these protests, the U.S. sent some Marines from Kuwait, a Marine task force, to help with that situation. Well, that left an opening in Kuwait, and so now the U.S. has deployed soldiers from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the 82nd Airborne Division, to leave there and to go to Kuwait. That will kind of fill that position. They will be able to help with the securing of U.S. personnel, equipment, and facilities, and they can also do additional missions if needed and as needed. I was at that briefing, and I actually was the one to ask Secretary Esper about Iranian deterrence, and I said, Secretary, we've added 14,000 U.S. troops to the region since May. You're sending about 750 more. Is deterrence working against Iran and against Iranian-backed proxies? Because we're still seeing all of these attacks, 11 or 12 attacks in the last couple of months alone. And he told me, he said, I don't really know what level we need to get to, the U.S. needs to get to in order to deter Iran or to deter Iranian-backed proxies. But the United States is going to keep putting pressure on these Iranian-backed groups, and they are going to make strikes and conduct preemptive strikes if necessary. That is a game changer. He said the game has changed here. Before, we saw there were attacks on U.S. forces, and when a contractor was killed, the U.S. responded with these five attacks, two in Syria, three in Iraq, against this Kataib Hezbollah Iranian-backed group. But now he says, if we know what's coming, we're going to make sure that we prevent it before it even starts.
Well, yeah, this is so important that you were asking about deterrence, because it does beg the question that after, you know, we saw the siege of the embassy, the militants then withdrew from the diplomatic enclave, some saying that they will return with weapons to remove the U.S. presence from Iraq entirely. Now, given that threat and the U.S. now deploying more troops instead of leaving, is the situation expected to get worse?
Well, I have heard every indication that there could be additional attacks, as you heard from Secretary Esper. And when I'm talking to experts about this, Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, he said this could open up a tit-for-tat that the U.S. may not want to go down, because Iran's goal is to destabilize the region and to attack U.S. interest. And so if the United States responds to everything that Iranian-backed groups respond to, then you've got a position where Iran can actually use that to make everything further destabilized, and that will actually allow Iran to win, as O'Hanlon told me. However, on the other side, you can't just allow Iranian-backed groups to kill Americans. That just cannot happen. And that's why Secretary Esper and General Mark Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have called on Iraq to do their job, so to speak, and make sure that Iranians are not allowed to attack U.S. interests in the U.S. embassy. They said that it's up to Iraq to help with the securing of these areas, and so far they have not seen sufficient help in securing American bases.
Very, very briefly, have the Iraqis asked the Americans to scale down their presence in that country? We've got about 30 seconds.
Interesting. I asked Secretary Esper that exact question just a few moments ago, and he said no. They have not asked the United States to scale down or pull out in any way. But at the same time, they did not condemn the attacks that, let's not forget, Iraqis were also wounded in that attack in Kirkuk. Mm-hmm. So Iraq is clearly trying to walk a fine line. They want good relations with Iran, their neighbor. They want good relations with the United States. And so we're just going to have to see in the coming days what Iraqis will do.
Well, if nothing else, we're seeing a war of words at the very least. Great reporting there from VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. Carla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Heidi.
Well, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has announced he is no longer bound by his self-imposed moratorium on long-range missile and nuclear tests. Kim also warned of an unspecified, quote, shocking action if the United States does not soften its stance in nuclear talks. But he did not formally abandon the negotiations, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
It's the clearest indication yet North Korea may soon resume nuclear or major missile tests. Kim Jong-un says he is no longer bound by his self-imposed moratorium on those tests. Kim vowed to continue developing his powerful nuclear deterrent, warning of an unspecified shocking actual action. As he did for most of 2019, U.S. President Donald Trump downplayed the North Korean warnings.
He's representing his country. I'm representing my country. We have to do what we have to do. I think he's a man of his word, so we're going to find out. But I think he's a man of his word.
Although Kim made lots of threats, most came with conditions. For instance, he suggested ICBM and nuclear tests would only continue if the United States continues its military exercises and weapon sales with South Korea. That suggests Kim is still open to talking, even if his demands are big.
As long as the so-called hostile U.S. policy continues, there will be no denuclearization. But if the U.S. withdraws hostile policy, it will denuclearize.
Analyst Cho Han-bum also points out that North Korea hasn't followed through on its threat to deliver a Christmas gift to the U.S.
For the time being, nothing is going beyond the red line.
But so far, Trump has refused to relax sanctions, insisting that Kim first agree to completely give up his nuclear weapons. Kim's message on Wednesday seemed to say he won't wait for much longer. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Let's take a look now at other stories making headlines around the world. Officials in Kenya say three people were killed Thursday when suspected Al-Shabaab militants attacked a passenger bus in coastal Lamu County. Lebanon has received a so-called red notice from Interpol for the arrest of fugitive ex-Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn, who fled Japan when he was waiting trial and has arrived in Lebanon. And in Britain, a vegan man is bringing a landmark legal action in which a tribunal will decide for the first time whether veganism should be protected in law. A majority of Turkish lawmakers on Thursday approved the government's motion to send troops to Libya. The troops are to help the UN-supported government in Tripoli battle forces loyal to a rival administration in eastern Libya. Those forces, led by the commander of Libyan National Army, Khalif Haftar, seek to capture the capital. Turkey says the deployment is vital to safeguard its interests in Libya and in the eastern Mediterranean. While VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi discussed the situation in Libya with Professor William Lawrence at George Washington University.
Well, the regional armed conflict has already begun. We have over 1,000 new Kremlin-trained and Kremlin-directed Russian mercenaries, over 3,000 Sudanese mercenaries, and Chadian troops as well, directly involved in the front lines of the assault on Tripoli. So the regional war has already begun. What's going on now is Turkey is getting involved with the UN-backed government to defend Tripoli from this attack. If that gets us to a better diplomatic outcome in Berlin, we would hope so. I think more parity on the ground lends itself to better diplomatic outcomes rather than an outright victory by Haftar's forces coming from the east.
Turkish Vice President Fuad Oktay said that Turkey would send the necessary number of troops whenever there is a need, but he also said Turkey would not dispatch its forces if Libya's rival government halts its offensive. What do you make of that?
Erdogan does not want to send troops, and he told the Tunisian new president that much in their meeting. What he would prefer to do is to support Tripoli just enough to help it defend itself from the attack. Erdogan wants to provide technology and arms, and that's what the Western government really needs more than it needs manpower. However, if the air advantage of the Eastern forces, both airplanes and drones, leads it to be able to kill a lot of the Western forces, then at that point, I think Turkish boots on the ground would be more necessary. But at this point, I think Turkey's only going to send military advisors, just as the Eastern government gets Russian and other military advisors.
But Egypt now is backing Haftar more than ever. Would that lead to a confrontation between Egypt and Turkey?
I think if Egypt wanted boots on the ground in Libya, they would already be there. I know there have been conversations between the Egyptians and many other governments, including the United States and Algeria and others, about how that would be an unnecessary escalation. We have to keep in mind that it's the Eastern forces that are attacking, not defending. So it's the forces that Sisi is backing that are getting lots of weapons across the Egyptian border and coming in by air from Jordan. And so, obviously, if the attack on Tripoli stops, a lot of this becomes unnecessary. And if Sisi believes that the Turkish troops are tipping the balance in favor of, you know, the Western government and the Eastern government needs to be defended, then I could see the possibility of Egypt sending troops in. But at this point, I do not think that's a likelihood. And I think a lot of the people suggesting that this draws Egypt into the conflict misunderstands that Egypt has been heavily involved in the conflict for many years now.
Turkey says the deployment is vital for Turkey to safeguard its interests in Libya and in the Eastern Mediterranean, where it finds itself increasingly isolated as Greece, Cyprus, Egypt, and Israel have established exclusive economic zones, paving the way for oil and gas exploration. Does that mean the Turkish involvement in Libya has an economic aspect?
Certainly, but that aspect is at most a tertiary or secondary aspect. There is a long-time maritime dispute between Turkey and its Mediterranean neighbors based on the fact that Turkey doesn't recognize island claims to maritime rights, islands such as Cyprus or Greek islands. And as a result, Greece, which is a signatory to the Law of the Sea Treaty, has made all these agreements with Egypt and Israel and others to try to establish the rights that Turkey doesn't recognize. So Turkey signed an agreement with Libya challenging that. But that agreement's non-binding under international law because third parties don't have to recognize any agreement between two governments. So that's a long-time dispute, and Erdogan just thought he could get one step forward and an advantage by signing this deal with Libya. But that's not why Erdogan is supporting the Western government. He's supporting the Western government for geopolitical reasons that have everything to do with Arab Spring outcomes and parties and ideological viewpoints that Turkey wants to support in the region, and very little to do with economics.
And that was Professor William Lawrence from George Washington University speaking there to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.
African Beats.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
The 62nd Annual Grammy Awards Show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick. Thousands of holiday travellers have been warned it is not safe for them to stay in bushfire-ravaged parts of eastern Australia ahead of more dangerous conditions at the weekend. A tourist leave zone has been declared for a large stretch of the New South Wales coast. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The mass exodus from southern New South Wales is underway. The authorities are urging tourists and residents to leave while they can. More dangerous bushfire conditions are forecast for southeastern Australia in the days ahead. Authorities are extending the evacuation zone in New South Wales, the nation's most populous state, to include more areas of bushland and national park. A week-long state of emergency will be imposed, which gives fire officials greater powers. As dozens of blazes continue to burn across several states, the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who's a strong supporter of the nation's large coal industry, is defending his handling of the emergency. He acknowledges that climate change is one of many factors fueling the blazes, but he insists his climate change policies are adequate and responsible.
Our emissions reductions policies will both protect our environment and seek to reduce the risks and hazards that we're seeing today, and at the same time, it will seek to ensure the viability of people's jobs and their livelihoods all around the country.
The crisis has been devastating and deadly. Today, the funeral has been held for Geoffrey Keaton. He was one of two volunteer firefighters killed when a tree hit their fire engine last month near Sydney. He was posthumously awarded a bravery commendation. Almost 1,300 homes have been destroyed in the state of New South Wales since the fire crisis began in September. At least 18 people have been killed. These are extraordinary times in Australia. The bushfires have brought terror into the lives of ordinary people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And while drought is fueling the fires in Australia, 3,000 kilometres to the north, more than 30,000 people have been displaced by flooding and landslides in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. Hundreds of neighbourhoods in Jakarta have been left submerged by fast-rising floods, forcing authorities to shut off electricity across the city. Several subway lines were shut down, as well as one of Jakarta's airports after its runway was submerged. At least 21 people have died as a result of the flooding, the victims either drowning, electrocuted, buried under landslides, or dying of hypothermia. The Jakarta area is home to 30 million people and is vulnerable to floods and earthquakes. The government plans to move the capital to East Kalimantan province or Borneo Island. 2019 saw a disease that's totally preventable claim the lives of more than 140,000 people, mostly children and babies, all because they missed getting two doses of the measles vaccine. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that unvaccinated children created a pathway for measles outbreaks globally.
Samoan parents never expected to face such grief.
I was shocked. It was very hard for me to accept what happened.
It's very hard to lose a child. She's gone and I never forget her. The way I try to teach her how to talk.
Measles claimed the lives of more than 80 Samoans, mostly children and infants.
Two shots of a vaccine could have saved those children's lives.
The vaccination rate in Samoa dropped to about 30% after two children died from a measles vaccine that was mixed with a muscle relaxant instead of water. Parents panicked, and anti-vaccination activists convinced them to avoid the vaccine. Then measles exploded on the island.
The hospitals and health clinics were overrun with very sick children. And there weren't enough healthcare workers and hospital beds to adequately deliver the services that they needed.
The Samoan government started a massive vaccination effort. It then turned to the CDC for help.
CDC also was asked to do training of healthcare workers to ensure safe vaccine delivery, as well as to monitor the quality of the immunization campaign that took place.
In 2019, more than 400,000 cases of measles were reported globally, with an additional 250,000 cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the first 3 months of 2019, the number of measles cases tripled over the same period last year.
The main reason for failure to vaccinate against measles is families, communities are not having access to the vaccine.
Two doses of the measles vaccine will protect children from the disease, yet conflict and poor health systems in low-income countries prevent families from vaccinating their children. In rich countries, vaccinations are declining too. Some parents are opting out of immunizations. The United States tops the list with 2.5 million children missing their first dose of the measles vaccine. In 2019, the CDC reported that more than 1,000 cases of measles in 31 states by late December, the highest number in 25 years.
And then in the United States now, we've got measles outbreaks and epidemics are becoming a new normal in this country after we've eliminated measles in 2000.
The WHO took away the measles eradication status of 4 European countries because of outbreaks and their low immunization rates.
In other words, we're backsliding.
Samoa concluded its state of emergency just before 2019 ended, but the resurgence of measles remains a global health problem. Unless children get vaccinated, there will be more deaths and more measles outbreaks in 2020. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
In news from Southern Africa, Isabel dos Santos, who is often described as Africa's richest woman, on Wednesday said an Angolan court order seizing her assets is politically motivated. Dos Santos is the daughter of former Angolan president José Eduardo dos Santos, and she has a fortune of over $2 billion. An Angolan court ordered her assets seized while she is investigated as part of President João Lourenço's anti-corruption drive. Eduardo dos Santos's 38-year rule as president was marked by allegations of widespread corruption, and some financial institutions say billions of dollars in state funds went missing. Now his daughter, Isabel, heads a business empire that controls companies in Angola and Portugal. Angola has sub-Saharan Africa's third largest economy because of its oil and diamond deposits, but the country remains poorly developed. VOA's International Edition continues.
VVIP. Hello, music lovers. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This Sunday, tune in for a full hour of Africa's best music. Chatty and electro dance music? Check. Classic Monday grill music? Check. Interview with founder of Ghanaian Hip Life, Reggie Rockstone. Check. See everybody. You hold somebody. There's this and so much more music for everyone in this show. So don't miss it. This Sunday, 1500 and 2000 UTC. On Music Time in Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 1730 UTC. Right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
And you've been listening to Voice of America's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us on this second day of 2020. Thank you to our director, Nadia Taha, our engineer, Patrick Dea, and I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington, wishing you a great day.